Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome to Soul Purpose Healing. We have Miss India Ari, Neo Soul Artist, kicking off another show for us with the question, am I my brother's keeper? And I feel this is such an appropriate type question to ask, which goes along with our theme for today, spiritual healing through correction. When our brothers or sisters, for that matter, have to be corrected in a way that they end up in the prison system, we have to become their keepers, especially if we know that that person has the heart to live his soul purpose. So my name is Beata. I am your host for another hour or maybe hour and a half of Soul Purpose Healing. Soul Purpose Healing is all about a journey back to our Creator's love, wisdom, knowledge, and compassion that we are missing so much in this earth. And we are going to talk about a little hell that we sometimes find ourselves in when we go to a prison system or we find ourselves in under correction. And if you haven't been listening to our show for long, I want to welcome you and thank you for listening. We're sure to entertain and enlighten and educate you and most of all empower you. These days we need to be empowered. Too much deception in this earth right now. If your eyes are open, your ears are open, you will see there's too much deception. And so we're here to open up your eyes of understanding. We're also here to take you to the metaphysical level, that which your eyes cannot see, because reality actually is in the unseen. We think that we're seeing the what we see with our natural eyes and the images we see, we think that's reality, but when you begin to study, especially the Hebrew letters and the Hebrew meanings, as our guest instructed us last week, we talked about last week the heaven inside of us, and most of us are not aware of that, that there is a heaven inside of us, but the whole purpose for our two shows last week and the week before was to help us understand that the Paleo-Hebrew letters were written ancient years ago and they have powerful meanings and they have a metaphysical message of energy, and the heaven inside of us is what is going to keep us and help us survive when we are tuned in to that heaven, which is connected to the stars. Now, from the beginning of our show, we pointed out, last July we started this show, we pointed out the importance of words. The words we speak are powerful. So if a person is sitting around and talking about they can't do this, they can't do this, I'm weak, I'm sick, then that those words become reality. And matter follows the mind. If the mind is weak and sick and not being proactive, then guess what? The body will be sick and weak and victimized. We like to be victims of everything, but really our guest is going to show us how powerful the mind is and how it can deliver us from any correction or penal system. And speaking of words, as I was preparing for this show, and I shared this with my guest earlier, the words penal brought to mind that our Hebrew lesson last week taught us. The word al-hahim. Al-hahim means the title, the plural title that we give our creator, sometimes referred to as G-O-D, the title. But the word al or el is a singular form of Elohim. Elohim means a plurality. That means the whole universe, the angels, the whole system of our being in the universe and above is Elohim. But then the plural of Elohim is Al or El, depending on how you want to pronounce it. It's two Hebrew letters, the Aleph or the Alpha and the Lamed. So when you look at the word penal, as in penal system, this corrective system, there are two words that jump out at me, and that's the word pen and al. So in some instances, you could think of this correction system that our brother was in as a pen for al, or a pen for our creator, the title that's given to our Yahuwah or Yahweh. And so words like that, and even the word criminal, my guest and I talked about the word criminal briefly, how that, even at the end of criminal, the word al appears again. So it's a consciousness awakening. When you see the word, the letters al, it kind of refers to this kingdom within us, this kingdom around us, this creator named Yahuwah, who is also called G-O-D, and then the criminal refers to crime and al. So just kind of an introduction for my brother, Rafa. I have known Rafa for many, many years, although we didn't have a lot of contact. We were friends through another friend. And when we heard that he had been challenged with this new journey that he went on, we have been praying for him and praying for him until he came out of that system. So I want you to sit back and open your ears, and we're going to have some really powerful conversations about what it means to be corrected in the spiritual level, in the physical level, on every level. We are multidimensional beings, and so we have to consider whenever something like this happens to an individual that there are multi-lessons to be learned. And so I want to introduce my brother and friend, Rafa, to Soul Purpose Healing. Rafa, are you there?
Yes, I am, sister.
Thank you, Rafa, for being here. How are you today? How does it feel to be out of the pen?
Oh, it's a wonderful feeling. I appreciate you having me on the show, Viata, and I pray I'm able to convey some good word, you know, for you and the folks. Thank you for having me.
And we're really blessed to have you, because those of us who have never been in the system, we are going to learn some lessons about what it means to be in correction and how to respond. So, Rafa, please tell us a little bit about your family background, your childhood, your upbringing. I always like to have my guests share the early parts of their journey, what they can remember about their childhood and their family.
Okay. Yes, that's not a problem. Just a little brief overview. I am a child, one of five remaining. You know, there were six of us born through our parents, but one of the babies died as a two-month-old infant, so I'm the middle child. brother and sister older, brother and sister younger. And I'm from New York, born and raised. I'm 46 years old right now. And let's see, I was born in Queens, New York, grew up in Corona, East Elmhurst. I have about 12 years of my life, first 12 years were raised up in the foster system with my oldest brother. And then I went to live with my parents right before I turned 13. And I stayed with them. I had a brother, younger brother, and two sisters there. And I was in that household with them for about 4.5 years. And had it, and my father was an abusive man, very violent type. So it got to a point where I knew if I continued to stay in that household, my life literally was in jeopardy. So I kept in contact with the foster family, and my older brother was still there. So I went back, which is most uncommon. You know, most people don't leave their biological parent home to go back to a foster home, but that's my account. And
well, that takes discernment, though, I think. If you recognize, you just like you said, you recognize this man was going to kill you.
Yes. Yes, it was.
So you made the wise decision.
Yeah, it was not easy or pleasant, but necessary. And
yeah,
turned out for the better.
From
that move, I went back, you know, to my old neighborhood where I had my roots, so it was not a big thing going back. I was already embraced by the home and the community, because I knew so many people. And it was maybe about 2 years after that my spiritual journey began in 1986. So I don't think that would have happened. So I wouldn't have been able to get on that path as easily as I did if I had stayed with my real parents, my biological parents.
Mm-hmm.
A forced, you know, violent type individual, very abusive. They're very controlling too, dominating. So we were in a very controlled environment and on lockdown somewhat. Go school, go home.
Wow.
So
early, huh?
And early, yeah. So.
So when you say spiritual journey, what did that involve?
That is when I learned about the Sabbath and began getting the spiritual awakening, where as an 18-year-old, I was all of a sudden had desires to listen to gospel music or church music and watch a religious program on TV. I was raised a Baptist. I'm a little boy, but I stopped going maybe around 10 years old, and I didn't go back until I was almost 19, and I joined up the Adventist, Seventh-day Adventist Church after I had learned about this Shabbat. And through one of the TV shows I was watching, I ordered the books, and there was a show called World for Tomorrow. It used to come on, and I was intrigued with the information. I went and did a lot of studying and so on. And then one thing led to another, and the next thing I know, I was keeping Sabbath and learning a lot from the scripture and getting in the church, and it just kept growing over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I was very hungry. You know, the Spirit, the Ruach, the Holy Spirit will plant a seed in you, and it's up to you if you want to feed that seed That's where the Mashiach spoke of the seed falling on good ground, and some fall on stony ground, some fall on rocks, you know. So I was blessed that the seed fell on good soil, and I was, Matthew 5, verse 6, at that time, until now, we're talking 27 years, 28 years coming up, was one of my favorite texts. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. And I can testify personally to that text that I lived that, and he did. He continually gave me continual growth in knowledge and information on all levels, health, you know, the not just in scripture, which I did a lot of studying, but socioeconomic issues, political, of course, and religion, health issues, law, all, it's all tied together. It's, as you stated in the opening credit of the show, we are multifaceted beings, and the society and the world we live in is a multifaceted universe, and like a binary system, we can't just be single-minded. We look at spirituality or religion as just maybe singing and reading the Bible or a sacred book, but it, of course, we know it entails a lot more. It's a culture, and this is what the Creator desires us to be a part of, his culture, the heavenly culture represented on earth.
So tell me, how did you get into barbering? My Rafa is a barber. He's a professional, very good barber, and I want to share this. I grew up in a barber shop, so I relate to your profession so much. My uncle owned a barber shop, and as young children, we helped him sweep up the hair, and we heard all the conversations that men talk about, and we spent a lot of time in the barbershop. Yeah, barbershop talk. So how did you get into that profession? I'm very curious.
Well, it's a funny story in a way that I never had. I always had it was in me as from little. I would try to play around with my brother's clippers. My foster brother had some edges, and I would try to do a little shaving and mess up my head. And then as I got older, I would try to cut my hair, and I'd mess it up, and I'd have to go in the shop and ask the barber, you know, back in the day where we had a neighborhood barbershop couple, and the guy knows you from a little baby, so he's the friend of the family, you know, so I would go to him and ask him, please help me out. You know, look what I did. I'd have a hat on and wait until everybody cleared out. And I could have been next, but I would wait and let them all leave. And he said, what's wrong? Why you wait? When I take off my hat, he just laughs and said, oh,
messed
yeah,
up
here. Come on. So it was a lot of trial and error, but once I found a guy that I really liked. He did my hair well, and it was hard to get him. And now I'm 18, 19, 20, and I got tired of I couldn't catch him, and other people would mess it up. So I said, I could cut it for free at home and be mad. Why am I paying you and I'm mad? So I stopped going, and I would do my own hair, and people said, wow. Where did you go? I want to go to that guy. And I said, I did it. And they said, can you do mine like that? And I was scared. It didn't come out that good, first couple, but I feel like, Job in a way, where it says that the Most High blessed the work of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
So that's happened with me. I can't take credit. He blessed my hands and helped me do good jobs. And I do it from the heart, too. I love it. If I didn't need money to live, I would still cut hair because the smile means the money to me, the satisfied customer. And that is a joy to me.
And so you've been cutting hair for, you've been cutting hair for what, about 20 years or more?
Oh, boy.
I'm counting, 30.
Well, yeah, more, 25 now.
25, okay, 25.
Yeah.
So what's been happening? What happened in the barbershop? Let's fast forward and tell us how this penal system journey started for you. As you can recall, what were the events that kind of caused you to make the decision that you started to regret, but then you had to just take responsibility for, right?
Yeah.
Did it all start in the barbershop, really?
Well, yes and no. That's a complex question. Yes and no.
Yeah.
I would like to, let me first say that being a spiritual man and having to go through what I went through was clearly something that took everyone, as you know yourself, including myself, by total surprise.
Mm-hmm.
It was not something that you would from me, something that you would expect from a brother in the faith. To
I would say I was in shock. I was in shock. That's a better word.
Yes. Yes. I would say when I realized what was happening, I was in the twilight zone. That's how I felt.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, to me, of course, very shocking and bewildering. But let me preface this statement with the scripture that I found maybe a year and a half, a couple of years ago, that jumped out at me, and I never really took notice of it in this manner until I was going through the situation. And that's in James, the book of James, chapter 3, verse 1, and it says, "Behold, our beloved, be there not, a matter of fact, let me, so I don't misquote it, let me just, here it is, it says, my brothers, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment." And that verse, like, punched me in the face about a year and a half ago, because I've read this book numerous times, but that particular verse jumped out at me because, as you know, I was blessed with the ability to be a teacher of scripture and history, among other things, and it seems to just applied to me so much when I read it, and I said, wow, this is true. And you think about when the Messiah, the Savior, spoke about the servant who knew his master's will and doesn't perform it, he will be beaten with many stripes because he knew his master's will. That was
Ouch.
Me. I can't claim ignorance or youthful indiscretion or anything. I was 43 at the time, and I became a convicted felon of in the United States by no one coercing me. I did something very foolish. I wasn't living a life of crime per se, but I had a firearm that I didn't license. I didn't have the state, you know, register it. And many people, with especially nowadays with the big battle going on with the Second Amendment.
Gun control, gun control.
With gun control, right. Many people would, you know, have different opinions about it. Some people feel that, you know, you shouldn't have to have a license for it, but that's a whole nother, that's another show, so we won't get into that, but.
Right.
we could spend all night on that, but.
Well, it's a divisive issue, to say the least.
Yes, to say the least.
Everybody's
clearly
got their opinion on this.
Yes. And, you know, we are taught to obey the laws of the land. So there I cannot claim, although whether we agree with that particular law or not, that I can't claim ignorance of the law or that I feel whether I agree with it or not was not the issue. Now, economics did play a part. It wasn't a total defiance on my part that I had the firearm. It was not like I disregarded and just didn't care. If I had the money to pay for the licensing, I would have done it. It was a little over $500. And this is, we're talking back in 2008 and 2009 now. And
wait a minute. Did you $500 just for a license to carry a gun?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, I had no idea it was that expensive.
Yeah, New York has a very high, and then you, even though you have the permit for it, you cannot, I'm in upstate New York where I reside now, but you cannot go into the city limits, into the five boroughs of New York City with a firearm unless you are a law enforcement agent. No one is to have firearm, whether they have a permit or not. You cannot carry that weapon. That's the city of New York, the five boroughs, Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and Staten Island. And you will get arrested and go to prison if you do. So it's very strict. So, but I was up here, upstate, in Ulster County. So I had this gun for protection purposes only. I never had any involvement with the law, police, and no criminal history at all whatsoever. So it was a lack of faith, I would say, also on my part to have it because feeling that I need to defend myself as opposed to allow our Heavenly Father to do that, which he has been doing all my life. So I had experiential knowledge of the protection I've been enjoying. So it was kind of a disrespect and disregard on my part to
of Elohim.
Feel like
of Elohim, because we talked last week about Elohim. And Elohim is plurality. It's multi-help, energies around you to help you. The heavens, the universe is Elohim. And you said that right. You were not conscious of that help. I think that's why anybody turns to a gun. They're not conscious of the help. I have a friend who, she's so conscious of the help, she wouldn't even think of bringing a gun or any of that. She's, I know who my help is. And so I hear you. I hear you on that one.
Yeah, and actually, no, I was very conscious, but I took a, that's why I said it was a lack of faith, because I took a different stance where I said, oh, now I'm getting a nice couple of nice cars. I need to protect myself in case somebody tries to carjack me. And that was not a good stance for me to take. It, you know, how the scripture says in Deuteronomy 8 that it is Elohim that allows you or gives you the power to get wealth. So
right.
Now I'm taking the blessings he's given me, and I'm like, well, thank you, but I take it from here. That was kind of like the air, the attitude I had, and that was wrong. So
Right. So you were trying to get rid of that gun, am I right?
Yes. By 2009, as many people know in this country, the recession had really dug in, and a lot of people were being unemployed, a lot of people losing their homes. It was, you remember, this is 4 or 5 years now we're talking, so it's not ancient history. We're still coming out of that period, actually.
Yeah, some people are still in it.
Exactly. It's, we're still feeling the crunch of it, you know, the residue of those effects. And I was, as a barber, a lot of people, you always need a haircut, but instead of maybe every 2 weeks, now the people will stretch it to a month or 5 weeks. So you're not getting the consistent flow that you're used to. You get a couple of days busy, the rest of the week is dead, but your bills are still coming in.
I know, because I had three men in this household, and they were cutting each other's hair. It was no barber. We don't have to go to the bar. They bought some clippers, and next thing you know, the kitchen floor was full of hair.
So there you go. You see?
And there went your business. I'm going to tell them it's all their fault.
No, don't do that, sister. No, you know, people, they would had to do. And,
I know,
we all
everything was in divine order. Yeah, we know everything's in divine order. So the next step you took was
where I figured, okay, I have something here that I could sell and get some bill money and get caught up. And I knew the owner of the shop I was working at, he was into firearms. So I approached him, and asked him would he be interested. He was interested, but he did try to lowball me and get it for a lower price, so I couldn't sell it to him. I said, well, I'm going to lose twice. I'm not going to have the money I need, and I won't have my weapon, so it's not. There's no benefit to me, so I declined. There was three of us in the shop, very small shop. His friend, who overheard us talking about this, came to me the next day and asked me, well, do you still have a firearm? You still have that gun, and do you want to sell it? And I said, yeah. I know somebody that will buy it, and they'll pay your price. I said, who is that? He said, oh, that's one of my people. And I trusting him because I know he's the owner's friend. And that was another error that I took where the scripture curses the man that trusteth in man in Jeremiah. So that became another step in my downfall, and I trusted him, who I only knew for 3 or 4 months, to bring somebody to me that I never met to sell a gun, and that was not wise on my part. So,
and the result was
I got set up. This guy is looking at doing life in jail if he ever gets arrested. So he sold his services to the police, where he is a confidential informant now, and we all know it now, but back in 2009, no one knew this. So I agreed to it, and he brought a police officer, undercover officer, to me. And the sale went down. I had no clue what was going on, and I sold it. It was a done deal. The officer left. They didn't arrest me that day because I told them I was selling weapons, plural, not a weapon, which he knew I only had not one gun, but he told them I was trafficking. So they didn't arrest me that day because they felt like, well, we could get him to sell more and let him lead us to this ring he's a part of, which didn't exist. But long story short, I got maybe, 6 months? They had me under secret surveillance, and I didn't know, and they were watching me, where I'm going and what I'm doing. And it was just a big, it was crazy. So 10 months later, I got arrested. I had left New York and went back down to Florida to get my life going back down there, and I have a little son. So I went back, and I'm leaving work one night, and I got pulled over for cops said I was doing a 52 and a 40, I think. So I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to get a speeding ticket. And he comes back and says, oh, don't worry about the ticket. You got a bigger problem. I said, what is that? He said, you got a warrant. I said, who? He says, you. I said, no, it can't be. I'm not doing anything. I don't get warrants. He said, yeah, you got a warrant. I double-checked it. We confirmed it. It's you, and we got to take you in. And I said, a warrant for what? And he said, weapons. And I said, oh, no. In my mind, I couldn't believe it. Like, how did they know about that? That was almost a year ago. And it was in New York. So what happened? That's why I was in the Twilight Zone. I couldn't believe what was happening. And they took me in, held me for 26 days. The New York officers, Ulster County, came and picked me up and brought me up here to New York. They extradited me. That's when I found out I was under all the surveillance, and they had indicted me, secret sealed indictment, which is a secret indictment. All of this unbeknownst to me. So I wind up here in the county jail. I had to go through the court system. And behind the scene, which we could talk about in a few minutes, I guess, the lawyers and judges, DAs, defense attorneys, all of them are in bed together, and they have a list of people. I had a public defender, and they get $300 a head for each case that they are given by the county to represent this individual, whether they lose or not. So, of course, $300 is not a lot of money to an attorney who could, in some cases, make that in an hour, not a case. So he didn't have any vested interest in the case. I was very poorly handled. The case was, what do you call, it's a legal term, they call it, not misrepresentation, it was, I'm sorry, I can't, it'll come to me in a second, but it's a legal term that they use where a lawyer is not doing to the best of his ability to represent his client.
Incompetent, maybe.
That's in the definition of it, of what it's called. Yes, it's an incompetent act on his part where he's not, or she is not, fulfilling their constitutional obligation to that defendant, because as you know, the Constitution says we have a right to legal representation whether you can afford it or not. And they get a list of people, and they make deals. Well, this one and this one, you can pay because we see this hand. But this one, they're going down. And here's the offer. And
you know what this reminds, you know, it reminds me of, just put a little humor on this song. When you said they were all in bed together, it's like these guys, and I guess there's not any women, there weren't any women involved, I'm assuming, all these guys in bed together, so they're having like a judicial orgy, and who gets screwed? You know, let's get down to the nitty-gritty here. It's like that's the reality of it. And then, again, it's not the reality because we want people to know what's unseen is really the reality of it all, because you had to go before a judge and tell them what this judge wanted to do and what who overruled the judge. Let's get to the reality of the unseen world here. Hallelujah.
Yes. Yes, that is. Because that's what the whole issue was really about. It wasn't about me and the court system in the physical, as you put it.
Yes.
It was a bigger issue here where I was in violation of heavenly principles of the Creator's will and His laws, where there is a verse in Ezra, book of Ezra, chapter 8, verses 21 through 23, that says, those who turn their back on Elohim, that they receive, when they turn their back on him, he gives favor to those who look to him for guidance, but his wrath and judgment is meted out to those who forsake him. That's exactly how it reads. So that was me. And there were a lot of factors on top of the things I mentioned to you where I feel like I had a lot of knowledge, but I wasn't living up to that level of accountability that I should have been. I was loose. And it was like he gave me a timeout, like a bop on the head, you know, when the little child was acting up.
Oh, yeah, big time.
You got to snatch him up a little and say, go sit over there for a minute. Calm down.
In Al's pen or penal. Yeah, the penal system. Here you go, brother. Pen, in the pen. Al says in the pen. Elohim, Yahuwah says in the pen. That's hard, but I love your story about the judge. Please share about that judge.
There's a judge in this county, and he was the former prosecutor of the county for maybe 12, 15 years of Ulster County, and in 2010, he became the superior court judge of the county.
Mm-hmm.
And
big ego,
so,
huh?
Yeah, oh yeah. But you figure now you have and he was a fearsome prosecutor, a notorious prosecutor who constantly came under scrutiny for what they call malicious prosecution, which is, that's a legal term for overzealous. You are too involved in this case, and he not that he doesn't know these people, but he just likes to prosecute and get conviction. So now you have a prosecuting attorney dressed in a black robe running the court, and that's who I came up under. I caught the sale. Our case was in December of 2009. Now I'm dealing. He became a judge in January of 2010. So that the timing couldn't have been worse, better, worse, both. But he is named Donald Williams. He's a hard man. He doesn't play. His motto when he was running for the Superior Court judge was, I want to hand out over 1 million man years before I come off the bench. That was his slogan.
Okay.
And he won, and he is doing it. I we won't have time for me to even get into that. But he literally is doing it every day of in the weekdays. He's doing that, and he tried to do it to me with another notch in his belt. I have a victimless crime. I sold my property, but I didn't get permission from the state, like the master, to say, okay, yes, you can have that, and you can do what you want with it. So I didn't get that permission, so now they deemed me a violent felon, violent criminal. Where I said, well, what violent? But that's the technical term they put on it. So it says, oh, this is a serious offense, and the DA's offer was 3.5 years. The judge overruled her. He said, no, I don't agree with that. Give him 6. And he told my lawyer in another meeting, that was the arraignment, he said, you need to advise your client that if he does not avail himself of the court's generous offer of 6 years, his time will be increased considerably. And he was not playing. So the guy tells me, hey, you better take this because he's not coming down. And if you don't, he's going to go up to 10. And if you don't take that, he's going to make you go to trial and take 15 because he knows he'll beat you in trial because they got you clean. You know, everyone knows he got you, so you can't, and you admitted to it, which I did. I never tried to deny doing it because I know what I did. I had to own up to it. I was asking for leniency, seeing that I had no victim. I had no criminal history. And I'm 43 years old. I said, are you trying to make me be 50 years old for selling my property to go to prison, really? And he was trying to do it. And the day that I was going in to take the plea offer of 6 years, I was doing what's called an allocution. They call a plea allocution where the judge reads off a numeration of what you could call rules and stipulations and making you state what you did and a lot of question and answer type. So while we were running through that, the judge realized that my indictment was defective. Now, this is like 8 months in. Mm-hmm. I'm in, been jail already.
Right.
Legally, an indictment is, if you have 6 months to indict somebody, and that's 180 days. I maybe was not 8 months. It was a little over 6 months, about 7, because I was at 204 at the day of the plea hearing. So the judge knew that was a problem, and he tried to remedy this issue, although I had a 2-count indictment of criminal possession and a criminal sale. He couldn't dismiss the indictment because it was too late. He couldn't get rid of the first count, but what he did was he went to the second count, which was the sale, which was the reason I was arrested. And that carried a statute rule years from 1 to 7 years. 1 for like a first time person and 7 for maybe a repeat offender. That's the max you could get. He came down from the 6 and he said, well, I'm going to go with the 3.5. And I had been, I guess maybe from November of 2009, November of 2010, until June of 2011, the Most High had been showing me in various ways about the number 3, that I had multiple experiences with this number 3, and that was the DA's original offer, but that's not what the judge was going with, and he was very, very upset about that. He couldn't give me that 6 year, but I wound up getting 3.5, which in prison time you get 10 days a month off of the year, of the month. So in a year, you do 10 months out of 12 calendar months. 10 months in prison is a year. So you take 3 years and 3.5, that would come out to 42 months. And you take 6 away from that, that leaves you 36. So that's what I did, 36 months, and 3 years flat, what we call a 3-year flat. And that was the Most High showing me you're not going to get 6, but I couldn't see it when I was going through it. I couldn't understand why, like, my jail number added up to 21, 2 plus 1 is 3. The room, the cell I was in, 21, 2 plus 1 is 3.
Yeah,
the jail number at the county was adding up to 3, 036912. The number they gave me when I went in the state was 11A3456. That adds up to 21 also. And I kept realizing there's no way that these random numbers that they're putting on me keep adding up to 3. It's not been more than 2. Coincidence means 2. It's more than 2 times that happened. So took it as a sign, and it came to pass that I did wind up getting a 3.5, which you do 3 years, and I learned so much in those 3 years of incarceration internally about myself and about life and the choices we make. I also learned, of course, a lot about the legal system, about the institutional system. I learned a lot about relationships with people, where people like yourself who stepped up on my behalf and showed so much love to me while I was going through.
Let me just share that we were following you every step of the way from the time you got in till the time you were going to the judge. We were here, and we were having prayer conferences, not just prayer meetings. We had conference calls for Rafa. Let's get Rafa prayer on out of there. And so there was, of course, lots of prayer going up for you. But we're coming up on the top of the hour, not that we have to stop. But I really think a lot of people want to hear how your divine protection for those 3 years. You know, you see movies like, what is it, Shimshock Redemption, this movie, I can't remember who was in it, but gives you the most horrible picture of prison life, you know, raping and just murdering. Right. And I know you told me that people were being murdered in there all the time. So share a little bit about the divine protection you had in there from those really horrible things that we hear about sometimes.
Well, yes, the prison system is a very evil institution. We here in New York, it's called the Department of Corrections, you know, New York State Correctional Facility, but we call it the New York State Correctional Facility because it's
sounds
a hotbed.
It's a
hotbed of corruption from the top down,
mm-hmm.
from the administrators and the legislators down to the civilian workers and the officers that work and run these institutions. And I must say, the violence has decreased quite a bit in the New York penitentiary as opposed to how it was maybe 20 years ago and back further. The reason for that is where you could get in a fight before and you just got in trouble. You know, one guy goes to the box, which is the solitary confinement area, and then another guy, if he's hurt, they ship him out, and that's it. Now everybody is catching a charge. You're getting a new charge. If you hurt somebody, you're going to get a new assault charge. If you hit or hurt an officer, you're going to get an assault charge. If you spit on somebody, throw urine on them, that's a charge.
So they tightened up their control on everybody, huh?
On everything. Even officers, you have a lot of lawsuits that come up where they can't just abuse you like they used to and just bust your head open and it was okay. It happens, but it's much less now. So I was fortunate to come in as opposed to, say, when I was a young man going in the 80s or even in the 90s, where it was, again, very violent. It's less now, but it's still there. And the sexual part of it is also changed. As we know, we're in a society of kind of like all in the reverting back in a way to the 60s of the love movement, the free love, and also the gay agenda is, we know, very big, and they have a lot of momentum and power in the world. So it's also the same in the prison institution. They have a lot of power, a lot of respect, fear. Mm. You cannot go around just calling somebody these derogative terms anymore because you can get a lawsuit. They have these hate crimes now. So
really?
Yes. You cannot, if you're threatened with a rape, if I tell you someone threatened, they want to get me tonight, yeah, that's it. That's all they need to hear. They're not going to, and they'll investigate later, but initially they're going to take that individual I pointed out and lock them up. Take him out of the population. They don't tolerate these things at all. So, and on top of that, it's just like I said, it's the society is different where it's more acceptable, and you don't have to rape or violently take sex from a man anymore like they used to. There are so many people giving it away these days, literally, that it's not a factor of, well, I need to go and sneak up behind them and knock him out. No, it's everybody has their pants down, sagging like they do here in the street.
They do
the same thing in there, and but it has other meaning, and it.
I understand that's where that started, this sagging pants. It started in prison, and you got young people walking the streets doing the same thing. Is that right?
Exactly. Not knowing the history.
Yeah.
Not knowing of the history.
My sisters and I are so bold. We drive along. When we see that in young people, we roll the window down and tell them, pull your pants up, boy.
Right.
Because they no idea what they're doing. They're just following, the lead. So, yeah, and listen, I hear you. Oh my goodness, the whole environment is like hell to me. You know, the worst part I would think would be the food, but that's just me. I don't know how did you deal with that food or lack of non-food is what it is. And you know, I feel like this. You have to be, when you're a vegetarian, you're on one level, you just stop eating animals. And then you go to a new level and you realize none of this stuff is really nourishing us. It's the spirit that's nourishing you. And so you have to keep going up and up, and you don't worry about the food as much because you're really strong in the spirit. It's a metaphysical thing. But in prison, with that environment and that chemicals that they bring, how did you deal with that? How did you feel about that? How did you overcome that?
It was very, very difficult where, you know, you're in an environment now. Prison is a world unto itself. It is the world that the adversary has created in opposition to the world that the Creator has made. And that's the best way I could put it. It is literally, this is what His plan is for all of us out here and as well as in there. It is total domination. They control everything, including what you eat and what you drink and what you can have and can't have. And they do not allow any medicinal, maybe what you could call herbs or medicinal medicine, naturopathic medicine. They do not allow those in the correctional facility. You are only permitted to partake of what they give you, the pharmaceuticals. And you can get packages of food. They will deem what you can get. Allow you to have a better way.
Now, did you receive any vaccinations while you were in there?
No.
Okay.
Other than tuberculosis, they do. Well, that's mandatory. They make you take a TB shot once a year, just to keep, because you're in an environment that it could pass. It could become an epidemic in a matter of a couple of days, literally, because there's so many people you're coming in contact with from moment to moment. So you figure each institution has anywhere from the smaller ones, maybe 450, up until the bigger institutions that have over 2,000 people. And you're constantly interacting and going around people, whether you're in the gym or the mess hall or going to a program, or whatever you're doing, you're always around people. So you have to. They say you have to get the TB shot. So I of course I thought, all right, I'll do that. But the other things, the hepatitis and all the what do they call that one, tetanus shot and all that. You can't sign a waiver and decline, which I did, of course, because I know what is in that stuff. So. But the food is very denatured, very, it's like you said, unfood. It's not really food. It's what they work with a company around the country, not just in New York, because I was in 26 days in Florida waiting extradition. It's the same thing. It's called Quick Chill, and Quick Chill is what is food that they have in a bag, a big, giant, thick plastic bag, like a Ziploc bag, but it's sealed, hermetically sealed. And all you do is dump. They have soup, vegetables, meats, pasta, just about anything they're serving come in this Quick Chill bag, frozen bag. And they have these big, giant pots, soup pots, and they a spaghetti pot, and they dump these bags in there. 15 minutes, and cook it, dump it in the pan, cut it open, dump the food in the pan, and they serve it. So there's not a lot of cooking done today. It's very economical, saves time, of course, much longer shelf life for the food. It's just, it saves the states a lot of money, but the stuff that they have in these bags is not real food.
Well, Rafa, listen, though, that's what we got out here in the fast food places. And the interesting parallel to that is people pay for that crap. Excuse my French, but what do you think they're serving up at McDonald's and Burger King and all these other fast, not to mention the GMO? You're getting the worst of the crop. If there's no life in this food, that's, people are paying for that. So, you know, listeners, wake up, wake up. We got slavery and prison right outside the system in our society. People pay for dead food. They probably bring the same bags to McDonald's and all those other places. I shouldn't be calling on McDonald's, but any fast food place, and even in the grocery stores, you can look at these boxes on the shelf, and there's nothing but chemicals in there, microwave dishes. So this is a message for those listening who think they're free, and if they're shopping in the way you just described, looking for bags and boxes, they're in prison too in their mind. There's the metaphysical power of being outside the prison walls, but you still have the same mind that you're a slave to these masters who are throwing these chemicals at us. But I want to get to the scene that you told me about where you saw the sea of colored faces. And how you looked up in the almanac about the statistics, where you're coming over this bridge into the prison system, and the feelings that overwhelmed you about what you saw. Tell us about what you saw and how you looked into the almanac to actually get the numbers.
Yes. Let me just for a second back up what to underscore what you were just saying about the food. Where the prison system, what a lot of people don't know, is a testing ground. They use, just like they do with the military, unfortunately, to these poor guys that are going in to serve their country, you know, and they are guinea pigs in a lot of cases, and they come back with all kinds of diseases because they have to submit to whatever they're told, is follow orders. In the prison system around the country, they're testing grounds both for food and for pharmaceuticals. That is a big industry that uses things that you would never hear of in the street, but they use them inside these institutions to find out, does this work? Well, let's see. Try it on these guys. What are they going to do? If they get sick, they give them a few dollars. You know, they're happy. And they don't have a voice. Who's going to listen to them anyway? They're criminals. See, that's the mentality they have. So they test the food. They give the clone meats to the institutions to see what kind of reaction is going to happen over the years. They've been doing it, and the pharmaceuticals the same way. So that is a whole, we could do a whole show just on that alone. It was very disturbing when I got to see that firsthand.
But you needed to see it, though. Yeah, you needed to see it,
but actually be victimized to it. I was a partaker of it where I had to eat. You know, you're in there, you got to eat. Got to eat something, so and unless you got a lot of money or somebody behind you that is going to put money on your account or send you packages all the time, you got to eat, and they know it. So,
that's where we get into the economics of that whole system, because what you saw clearly demonstrated it's an economic game, and the power is not with the men of color.
Right, right. And that, now that bring up to what the first next question you just brought up about what I saw. And we all know in the country that we live in, America, that the incarceration of black males is not an uncommon thing. It's not a surprise, and it's not new. This has been going on, you know, for hundreds of years. So,
From slavery to prison.
Yes, it's a book that's out right now. I forget the author. It's called The New Jim Crow, Dealing with Mass Incarceration. And it deals with just what we're talking about right now. And you, we can know this, but when you actually are in it now and it's your life and you see it's, wow, it is just, it was very shocking and disturbing to me when I went, what I was explaining to you before about the reception facility that the state has, where when you come from a county jail, they bring you to a reception facility, and they have about three of them at least that I know of still open in New York State, one in the west, northwest New York around Buffalo, one here in the Fishkill area, Dutchess County, and they have another one in the mid-range between upper west New York and down here in the lower eastern New York in the Elmira area, and maybe another one or two, but these are the three hubs. And then there's another one, too, called Ulster. That's a reception facility also in this area.
Right.
And they classify you. They get you up what programs you need, if you need a vocation, if you need to get a GED, because that's a mandate above the state. If when you come into prison, if you don't have a high school diploma, they make you get a GED. And that's not a bad
thing. Kind of them. How kind of them.
But, of course, and I like the way you said it, yeah, because it's not out of love. It's of course, it's a money thing. Because they put me in it until, and I have a year of college, and they put me in the GED class until I could have my diploma shipped in. They said, well, we don't know if you graduated, and we don't have proof, so you got to get it. And I said, well, how am I going to do that? I'm in prison. So, well, you could call the Board of Ed and give them my name, and they would say, they'll run through this computer system and say yes or no. No, you have to do that. So they know that's going to take time. So 4 months, I was in a GED class because I took a moment. I had to contact somebody to contact the on the outside, contact Board of Education to get them to send that information in, because the institutions out here, whether legal, medical, education, or whatever, they acknowledge someone that can pick up a phone and call in a letter and asking for some help from inside a correctional facility. They don't, it's not a priority, but if you could call for me, it's, of course, going to make the wheels go a little faster. So they capitalize on all of these things. And how
well,
that,
the big thing they capitalize on is, yeah, well, let me just say the big thing they capitalize on is that some people are not able to have good attorneys. And so they capitalize on cattle management, just moving them in, moving them in. So what did you discover in those almanacs? I want our viewers to hear what you, the bold statistics about this whole system.
Well, we as the Most High people, we and just in general, as a woman, you could attest to this, I'm sure, Yada, that there, well, you married one, but as a woman, I'm sure you'd be able to identify with what I'm about to say, that most women in this country, black women, they feel that there is a shortage of men, of men of color, black men in good standing, of men
mm-hmm.
that are not on drugs, or men
right.
that are not gay, men that actually mm-hmm. want to be with a woman and
yes.
that can do something for that woman
mm-hmm.
besides getting
mm-hmm.
pregnant. So
be a good companion.
Yes. And I saw why that is the case, because when I, maybe a couple of days after I got to the downstate, a reception institution facility,
mm-hmm.
I was going, they have us in camps where it's about 25 or so, 30 people, and it's a little group, and they have, there's this big, monstrous facility, so you have, you know, scores of these little camps, little groups now,
mm-hmm.
all when they make a mess hall run, which is a chow run, call for chow, which is around 11 o'clock, 7 in the morning, 11 to 12, and from 4 to about 4:45. That's how they do their meal throughout the state, the meals,
mm-hmm.
breakfast,
mm-hmm.
lunch, and dinner. And I was walking through this long tunnel, which reminded me of the tunnel that I hear so much about, called the tunnel, or what was it called, the point of no return, or
mm-hmm.
the one in on the Ivory Coast where
okay.
our ancestors went through.
Yeah.
And, yes, they went through that tunnel, and the next thing you know, they were standing at the brink of the end of the tunnel, and the
right.
it stops right there at the beach front, you know.
And
the
they load them
right
up.
There. And
yeah.
they load them on the ship
up.
And brought us here. And
mm-hmm.
that's what that tunnel reminded me of. And I saw this sea of faces, just a sea of black faces, black men, mostly young, 30 and under. And, I mean, hundreds. I'm looking down about half a mile, maybe not half a mile, quarter mile,
mm-hmm.
More accurate, about a quarter mile I'm looking, 4 or 5 blocks long, easy, just companies of black men. You see a little white face speckles out throughout the crowd here and there, but 90% easy is black and Spanish. It was so painful to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these guys are doing long stretches. They're not coming home with like I got a little 2-3 year. We're talking 10, 15, 25 years they're looking at. And not to minimize, because most of them have done something wrong, but it reminds me of something Lauryn Hill said, that most black children don't lack ability, they lack opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunities afforded us in the what we call a hood, in the ghettos, are not what are afforded to our counterparts. And so we're somewhat steered into minimal of good choices, where if your parents or mom, which in most cases is just mom, you know, who knows
right,
where
raising
daddy,
the children,
how if you can get to college or trade school, there, you know, that's one option,
mm-hmm.
which is not very realistic in a lot of for a lot of people.
And you
work.
Said the statistics are right there before you, right? In the almanac, the statistics show the picture that the majority of people being arrested are not black, but they're actually Caucasian, right?
Yes. Yeah.
but they're not going to jail.
I wanted to. They made, there was a list in the almanac. There was a 2012 almanac that I looked at, and it was a section in it that dealt with the criminal justice system. Around the middle of the book, I can't remember the page, and it dealt with major crimes by category, you know, murder, rape, armed robbery, burglary, assault, and so on down the line, and drugs and all of these different crimes, okay, possession, sale, whatever, and weapons and so on. So you look at, they have by the crime and by the race, right in almanac, black, Latino, white, and other. And the only two of the maybe 12 categories that they had where we led in the arrest department as perpetrators of these particular crimes. And I remember one of them was for drug abuse, drug use, like
drug
being
use,
arrested
okay.
as a drug user. And I don't remember what the other one was. Might have been robbery, but everything else, we were thousands. It gave numbers, literally, by around the country.
So they're keeping track of these numbers.
Yes, and this was for the year of 2012. Anybody could look it up. You did all 2012 almanac. I tried to find it today, but I couldn't access it. I found it, I wasn't able to access it.
But the major
online
crimes like murder and rape, you're saying those are not being done by people of color, but of Caucasians.
No, the drug selling, the
drug
selling, burglary, assault. All of that, we're not leading in any of those things. The ones, the two that were, it was very small things, and not to minimalize, but out of those major crimes, the least two were the ones that we let in. The others were way disproportionate numbers, 400,000 or 200,000 of white compared to 80,000. Black, or 80,000 white and 15,000 black. So I'm
and then
saying,
out of
well,
the 400, go ahead.
So I'm looking at this, and it's confusing because I said, this can't be. It's impossible. But when I turned the page, I saw the next chapter was not arrest, but conviction, crime, major crime. Now it flipped. Where we led in those categories, all of everyone, 100%. We only had maybe 10, if that, of the major crime arrests, but in conviction, we were 100% over the top compared to our counterparts, white males and black males. And that was evident from my eye, from what I was seeing. I showed a lieutenant, a female, Jamaican lady in the fish kill facility I was at, and she looked at it and she said, oh yeah, we know this. And so my buddy sitting there with me, he says, well, how is this going on if everybody knows it? Where are they? And she said, they home. You know, they got money, they got lawyers, and they got favor. And that was very very serious for her in her position to tell us that, to be so candid, because if her superiors heard her say that, she could get in trouble, if you could imagine, for being that honest. But
yeah,
they have
yeah.
favor. Even if they
yeah.
don't have money, they figure, well, give them a YO, and the YO is their youth, meaning youthful offender. So you might get a little probation, a little county jail time. But we're going to seal that. So that doesn't come up. When you go for a job when you're 25 and 30, that's not going to come up. But for us, we don't get that out of the youthful offender. You going to jail. And
listen, Rafa, we're coming up on a few. We only have about 5 minutes, and this is just so interesting. I could go on and on, but I think our listeners want to hear what's next. You know, what do we do now? This is all information that some people may have never heard before, and some of it we all know well, too well, and yet we want to know what do we do next. You know, I can't help but think of O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson had the money. He had the attorney. And he was freed, and he wasn't wise enough to stay low-keyed and stay out of trouble. And that all that is to say is that you're going to reap what you sow anyway. You may think you're getting away with something, but my feeling, my belief is that we all reap what we're all going to reap what we sow. The law of the universe rules in this land, whether you like it or not. So, Rafa, please... let's wrap it up and summer. Give us a summary of what you're doing, what you're going to be, what's your goals now? What are your goals now that you have all this knowledge and all this experience? I keep saying you need to write a book, but what do you feel are the most important things your Heavenly Father, our Creator Yahuwah, wants you to be doing now?
Well, yes, sister, main, I guess you could say the main, couple of main things, I would point out, there are so many, but I'll point just two, is, of course, trust. It's about relationship. Our Father wants us to have a real relationship with Him, not just knowledge of Him, but a relationship with Him, because if I didn't have that relationship with Him, I wouldn't have made it through that experience. And
you're so
also that it's about living up to the light that you have. Everyone is on different levels, but if you're faithful and you live up to the light that you have, then your understanding, what you're convicted of as true, and you're doing your best to live up to that, He honors that. And He will bless you. But if you don't, no matter how much you know, you will incur some wrath, because I tell everyone my life as an object lesson. Don't play with the Creator. He is, in these last days and times, He is not playing. This is serious business, and He's looking for people to reflect His glory. And that's what we're called to do.
That's right. I am so grateful that you shared from your heart, and you really are expressing what you feel and what you've seen. And so I hope everyone listening will share this message and tell your friends to listen to this message, because it's so important to know what's going on in there. But more important than that, is that, like you said, we need to have a relationship with our Creator. And I want to invite all my listeners to begin to see your Creator as your husband. Become intimate with this force of the universe we call Yahuwah. The word G-O-D is a title. There's no intimacy in G-O-D, my brothers and sisters, friends, family. There's no intimacy in calling on this Creator of the universe, God, or G-O-D. We want to invite you to start calling the Creator by His name. You know, they took the name of the Creator out of the Bible almost 7,000 times. Those
That's
of us
right.
who have been studying the Scriptures for years, this was discovered by us, and we were in shock, and we said, oh, my goodness, we can't call Him by Lord and G-O-D anymore. We got to call Him by His name. They took it out. Who took it out? The scribes, those who had other agendas. They took out the name. So we want to encourage you to become more intimate. Call the Heavenly Father by His name, Yahuwah. Learn the language. Learn the language of our Creator. which is Paleo-Hebrew. Learn the Hebrew language of our Creator and start thinking of the heaven inside of you. You know, last week we had this show on, and I have to share this, and I found out that while we were doing our show on the heaven inside of us with Brother Shemuel, there was a Super Bowl going on, and there was a man on the stage singing a song at halftime called something about locking out of heaven, being locked out of heaven. And all there was the most popularly viewed show ever, they said. It set records on viewing.
Yeah.
So people were watching Bruno Mars singing about being locked out of heaven, and children singing Prepare, and they're saying that there was a message in that, prepare or you're going to be locked out of heaven. We on this show are telling you heaven's inside of you. Get to know what's inside of you. Get to know your Hebrew roots. Be proactive. These cells in our body are very intelligent. By the grace of Yah, Rafa survived that those chemicals that they called food. Now he's recovering and being restored by the same force that kept him alive in there. It wasn't that food or that chemical. It was the spirit of the Most High Yahuwah that kept him alive. So we need to get to know that spirit, that force called Yahuwah, because we're all in prison right here in this country. And unless you know the Creator by his name, unless you get intimate with him and his word, you could all be back in that same system, what that they call correction system. So thank you all for listening. I am so grateful that we have this time to spend with our brother, and I'm going to take us out on a song by India Arie called Thy Will Be Done. We need to know what the will of our Creator is so we can survive, not just survive, but thrive. We're going to thrive. As long as you're listening to this show, we're going to be proactive. We're going to thrive and let the brain that the Creator has given you work on your behalf to help you thrive and grow and be empowered. And if you need help in this area, go to my website, www.holistichomeandbodycare.com, and I have a page where you can get a 15-minute free consultation on how to get you started on the road to self-help. There's a revolution going on. It's called a self-help revolution. We can no longer depend on the systems of this world, the system of this country. We cannot depend on Obamacare. Let me just go ahead and say that. You have got to start having a self-help revolution starting with you and then reaching out and helping others and having that relationship that Rafa is inviting you to have, a very close relationship with your Creator, the only one that can help you. So thank you again, and I'm going to go out with a beautiful song by India Arie. I Will Be Done.
Sorry.
Thank you, Rafa, for being with us. And
yes,
shalom.
Thank you. Shalom.